I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Laying the first stone, a turning point for the Chad people. That was the slogan on ExxonMobil's banner when it inaugurated a 650-mile pipeline from the oil fields of this crushingly poor African nation to the Atlantic coast of Cameroon. It's hardly catchy, but it's a groundbreaking pledge. The Chad-Cameroon pipeline would not just be an energy project, but a development project. The money wouldn't just enrich Western oil giants and corrupt leaders. It'd build schools and hospitals, roads and homes, and give hope to the poorest villages en route. If it meets those goals halfway, it would be an African miracle. Oil has been Africa's curse. Everywhere it's been sold, the people have got poorer or worse. Oil money's fueled brutal wars in Angola and Sudan. In Nigeria, it created a kleptocracy, oppressed a people, fouled the Niger Delta. And today, 300 billion petrodollars later, the average Nigerian lives on less than a dollar a day. So ExxonMobil et al. Set out to do things differently, rooting under the rainforests and around the pygmy villages and constructing a financial route from oil well to mud hut, cutting out the greedy hands in between. The first oil's in the pipeline, but, say the critics, the money pipes have already sprung a leak. Connection listeners, can oil save Africa, or will it remain a curse till the despots go? Should it stay in the ground till the corrupt old guard are toppled and the country's books are clean, can you expect oil giants to be Africa's saviours? And with the Middle East in turmoil, should the US be turning to Africa for its oil? This hour we'll be talking with two people who know the story of oil in Africa very well. But first, I spoke a little bit earlier this morning with Samuel Ngwifo in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Samuel is director of the Centre for Environment and Development, and he's been monitoring the effects of the pipeline project on the villages in Cameroon. I asked him how what was happening on the ground compared to what the oil consortium had promised.
The result is very far from what was expected by the communities. They have been suffering a lot during the construction. The longest part of the pipeline is in rural areas, where you don't often see so many people coming in with a lot of heavy equipment. So this was one of the major problems. A lot of noise in very quiet villages. The other problems were the fact that there were very few people who got a job with the construction, and there were a lot of foreigners coming from out of the villages, working in the village for the construction, and really disturbing the social life in the village. In addition to all that, the compensation that the communities were supposed to get for the destruction of their crops was not always paid on time, or they did not always get the proper amount. There were around 4,000 people whose crops were destroyed and who had to receive a compensation. But up to now, we still have more than 800 cases which are still pending, cases where the victims did not yet receive the final compensation. And now construction is completed. First oil has started flowing, but for 800 people, they have not yet received any compensation.
Has the pipeline, in your view, you've talked about money and you feel that the villagers have been cheated, but what about disease and social impact? I mean, are you saying that people are actually suffering, or just they're aggrieved because they didn't get the money they were hoping for?
In addition to the fact that they did not receive what was promised to them, they also received a lot of things that they did not expect. A lot of water sources were destroyed during the construction, and the villagers had no solution for drinking water. Some of the villages up to now have no solution for access to drinking water. And this have resulted into more and more waterborne diseases in a lot of these villages. And in addition to that, there were a lot of sexually transmitted diseases, and for almost all the observers, the pipeline resulted into spreading AIDS and HIV along the pipeline route. It is very difficult to give the figures of this, especially because the government and the consortium, Exxon, refused to gather information, to gather data on the quantity of people along the pipeline route who were infected with HIV AIDS before the construction. their project will have a terrible impact on the spread of HIV/AIDS, they refused to do the first gathering of the data that was requested from them.
But Samuel, don't you think a lot of these problems are just temporary as the pipeline is being built and the consortium says that it is being buried, they've gone round villages? Isn't this just a temporary thing?
I can see at least two arguments against that. The first argument is that what they call temporary for most of the villagers affected is not temporary. When you destroy the farm of a villager, sometimes this is the work for a whole life. And for the village, the villager to rebuild his farm, this will take some few years. What the consortium sees as being very short-term impact, for most of the villagers impacted, this is a very, very long-term and structural impact.
Are the villagers very angry?
Yeah, a lot of people are very angry, but I wanted also to tell you about the HIV/AIDS. This is a very, very long-term impact because the workers coming from everywhere in Cameroon and walking along the pipeline road in all those rural areas were spreading AIDS or getting AIDS from there, and they will bring it now back to their own villages very far from the pipeline. And from there, many people say AIDS will be spreading all over the country and all over the region, including neighboring countries. And this is not a short-term impact.
Samuel, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thank you so much.
I'm joined now by Ken Silverstein, a staff writer with the Los Angeles Times, who's written a three-part series about the pipeline project, and by former Ambassador to Chad Donald Norland. Welcome to you both. Connection listeners, you can join the conversation on 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ken Silverstein, if I can start with you, a very grim picture we heard from the ground in Cameroon there. Chad is supposed to be the country that benefits even more because it's the one with the oil. What were the promises made when this project was first inaugurated?
Well, the sponsors of the project, primarily the oil consortium led by ExxonMobil and the World Bank, sort of pitched this as possibly a model for future oil development in the third world, not just Africa, but the third world in general. And they said it would not just be an energy project, but a development project, and that for the first time, revenues from oil would be invested in important sectors like health, education, and other social programs. And that really for the first time, the people of Africa would benefit in a significant way from a big energy project of this sort. And there were a number of important steps that were taken to try to ensure that the the consortium gets well over half of the revenue from the project. Chad gets, I think, about 80% of the money that will be distributed to the two African countries. And Cameroon is not subject to any sort of restrictions on its oil revenues. But Chad's revenues will be put into an offshore bank account. And there's a so-called college of nine members that will oversee the spending of that money. The government will have to request that the college approve its spending of the oil revenues. And the spending is supposed to go primarily towards social projects.
Okay,
again, health and education.
Supposed to. Ambassador Norland, you have hailed this deal as absolutely unique. Of course, when you're talking about money getting straight to the people of Chad and Cameroon, you have to circumvent I don't want to say corrupt, but leaders who corrupt regimes, perhaps, or corrupt leadership. Don't want to line the pockets of the middlemen. How was the deal struck?
Well, the deal was struck by a number of important concessions, as a result of a number of concessions from various parties. But let me just give a little background to this. I'm giving you the perspective of having worked on African affairs for about 50 years. Ever since independence, the countries of Africa, and there have been about 50 who've come to independence in the last 40-plus years, the overriding priority of governments in cooperation with the World Bank and so forth, the overriding priority has been to find a formula, some key to unlock the secret of sustainable economic development. Now, as has been pointed out, the search has eluded everyone up to now. no one has found this key. There have been some marginal gains. There have been some sectoral gains. But the conclusion was reached early on that this could not continue, that it's not just the resources that come from extractive industries. It's all resources. Look what's happened to World Bank loans, to bilateral aid in the billions given to not just African countries but to other countries around the world. All those resources have been wasted, have been squandered. So the focus has been on what new method of approach could possibly result in the benefits of these resources going to the people of the country.
And what is the priority? Is it to circumvent the government or to make sure the government
Yes.
keeps its word?
It is to take these resources out of the hands of the president of a country or in his clique of followers, and to make the process responsible to the people of the country.
But when you're talking about these lofty aims, there is another party in here, which is the oil companies as well.
Yes.
You can't expect them to act like benevolent aid organizations, which is...
They don't want that responsibility. They want the responsibility to be to the government. The idea of this monitoring group, as Ken has just mentioned, is to assure that the decisions about where these resources are spent are made by people responsible to the people of Chad, and that means in the case of Chad, it's the National Assembly that has by law. And Judy, this is the first time in history that a country has agreed to infringement of its sovereignty to the extent of saying that the resources will go offshore, and then secondly, to put the spending responsibilities to a committee of nationals that is by law required to see that those expenditures go to, quote, public health and social affairs, education, infrastructure, rural development, environment, and water resources. Nobody can say that the law is going to be followed to the letter. In very few countries is that the case. But this is a unique experiment that gives hope that perhaps at last these resources will escape the personal control of the leadership and a clique of his followers and go to the people. It is an experiment.
Well, we'll be looking
at an experiment.
We'll be looking at the results just after the break. But Ken,
yes.
Just briefly before the break, did this deal elicit a great deal of hope at village level in Chad and Cameroon when it was first mooted?
Yeah, I think so, because I don't think when you go to places like Cameroon and Chad in particular, which is one of the five poorest countries in the world, if you have a huge American oil company coming in promising to build a pipeline, a $4 billion pipeline, and there's all this talk about how it's going to benefit the poor and how the people finally are going to start seeing improvements in their lives. I mean, it generated enormous expectations in the villages.
And
some of it may be a little bit unfair, evenly. People might have, you know, their expectations may have been too high in some ways. But at the same time, the consortium, I think, stoked those expectations by making a lot of promises and trying to sell the pipeline project to the population.
Well, we'll see if those promises are kept right after the break. Connection listeners, West Africa sits on top of millions of barrels of oil, and America's increasingly turning there to meet its oil needs. Can oil save Africa from poverty? Call us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. With me to talk about an oil pipeline running from Chad to Cameroon and an experiment by oil companies to reduce poverty there are former ambassador to Chad, Don Norland, and LA Times staff writer Ken Silberstein. So, can oil dollars end poverty in Africa? Join us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Ken Silberstein, just before the break, we were talking about all the expectations when this deal was struck. You've been there. What's the reality in Chad?
Well, I think that there's a fair amount of disappointment. Again, it's partly a question of expectations. People had enormous expectations. In Chad and Cameroon, there was a flurry of activity that was generated by the pipeline construction. So you had a lot of new economic activity, and it did create some jobs. A lot of those jobs, though, turned out to be very, very temporary, sometimes a matter of a week, sometimes a matter of a couple of months. But as construction wound down and the jobs started disappearing, and now, I mean, there are very few jobs left, in fact. This is one of the fundamental problems, I think, of oil, is that it doesn't generate jobs. It just doesn't. I mean, you build a pipeline, you create a lot of temporary jobs, but when the construction's over, I mean, there are 100 permanent jobs in Cameroon resulting from this pipeline, and maybe 200 or 300 permanent jobs in Chad. So the employment is minimal. So and jobs are really the only way to fight poverty. I mean, that's the number one anti-poverty measure is creating employment. So oil doesn't do that, and it becomes sort of an enclave that has few connections to the rest of a country's economy. That's one of the big problems. And so now construction has wound down. There are very few people permanently employed. There's been some compensation paid. There have been some problems with the program, but a lot of the money has been paid out. But the impact is pretty marginal. I mean, if you look at Cameroon, Cameroon is just not going to benefit. I don't think anyone can say Cameroon will benefit in a significant way from this project. $16 million a year, roughly, is what Cameroon is going to get from this oil project over the next 30 years. That's about a dollar per person. It's not going to make any significant impact at all. And the construction's over. So in Chad, there's some hope, if the money is invested properly, that it could make a big difference. And that remains to be seen. But I think there's some grounds for skepticism on that front as well.
So your belief is no long-term benefits. What about the short-term impact? Do you see specific examples of destruction or misery created by the building of this pipeline?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, for the most part, no. I mean, they, you know, the pipeline did not cause widespread destruction of the forest in Cameroon. I didn't see that, and I haven't seen anyone talk a lot about that. I do think it caused, in some villages, absolutely, some, you know, as Samuel was saying from Cameroon earlier, it did create some problems. I think it's more not what the pipeline did, but what it didn't do. It did not cause much of an impact. It has not made a difference in the lives of most people, and I think people are bitter about that. Now, it is fair, I think, for people who still have hope for the pipeline to say, well, look, the oil money hasn't started flowing yet. And that's true. If, in fact, in Cameroon, I'm sorry, but forget it. It's just not going to help Cameroon. There's not enough money. In Chad, it is a lot of money. And so the question is still out. Will the government invest that money properly? And if it does that, it could make a big difference in people's lives. But as I said, there are grounds for skepticism because the regime there is notoriously corrupt. There's very little democracy, and there's no history of the regime ever using any money wisely.
Absolutely. So, Ambassador Norland, I mean, you know, the signs are not good, are they? The first money that the government got, $4.5 million signing bonus in the year 2000, President Deby went straight out and spent it on arms.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that has been a very important a reason for questioning the whole situation. But let me note that when the bank learned of this use of the funds, incidentally, I should say that the $25 million was a bonus for signing, and there was a question as to whether that was to come under the terms of the overall agreement for spending of funds. The bank took the view that it was still subject to those controls. The government of Chad said, no, we have security priorities that we have to meet. So they spent the money. The bank reprimanded the government of Chad and got them to promise that they would never, first of all, never do that again, and secondly, that they would use the remainder of the $25 million for the purposes specified in the legislation. So in a sense, it was a good opportunity to demonstrate the healthy effect of the bank's involvement.
Another issue, really, though, is you're saying President Deby got his wrist slapped on this occasion,
yes,
and promised never to do it again. And this oversight committee is keeping tabs on him. He sacked the head of the oversight committee.
Actually, there's some question as to whether the word sacked is appropriate. I defer to you if you have that in good form. But the person who succeeded the head of the oversight committee comes from the bank, head of the bank, excuse me, and is very well regarded. And I understand that there's, and in Chad at least, there is no suggestion that this was a deal that was engineered in order to better control the oversight committee.
Can I interject for a second?
Go ahead, Ken.
On the signing bonus, I wanted to make a couple of points. It was a $25 million signing bonus, and he spent $4.5 million on arms of that. Whether or not that money was technically under the terms of the World Bank agreement on how to spend the money, everyone agreed it was a very bad sign that he would use that early money for weapons. And I think one thing that's very important here is that, yeah, the bank slapped him on the wrist, and he promised never to do it again. But that was in the year 2000, at the very early stages. Debbie, the president of Chad, was still desperate for the World Bank support and the oil consortium support. He was still very much subject to international pressure. What's going to happen in a year when he is drowning in oil revenue? He has all the money he wants. I believe that there's a significant question as to how much influence and leverage the bank is going to have in a year or two when he has untold sums of money and no longer need. I mean, the pipeline is built now. He needed the approval of the bank to get the pipeline built. Now that it's built and now that he's very soon to have a lot of revenue, I'm not sure the bank's influence is going to remain as strong as it was a few years ago.
Okay, Connection listeners, are you cynics as well? Can oil save Africa from poverty? Call us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Joined by someone who's probably a very good person to answer that question. On the line from Italy is Terry Lynn Carl, a political science professor at Stanford University and author of a new report called Bottom of the Barrel, Africa's Oil Boom and the Poor. Terry Lynn Carl, are you cynical about what's going on in Chad, Cameroon?
Well, I don't know that cynical is the word. I am very, very skeptical that there will be any poverty alleviation in Chad as a result of this pipeline. The reason I'm skeptical is that I have been studying the impact of oil on oil exporting countries all around the world, and the evidence is very clear that oil revenues do not reduce poverty. That there has not been any single case, with the exception of Norway, of any country that depends on the exports of petroleum that has subsequently been able to produce better what we call human development indicators or an alleviation of poverty. If you look at countries like Venezuela or like Nigeria that have years and years, decades of dependence on petroleum, we can see that virtually the last 40 years of development have been wiped out, and people in those countries are living at 1960 levels. So the problem is not, I think, whether the pipeline right now is doing harm. The question is, will these oil revenues, particularly in a place like Chad, in the end, alleviate poverty.
And is there
the record of all other oil exporting countries is no. Again, with the exception of Norway. No, it will not. Not only will it not, but it will increase inequality. It will increase environmental damage. And I think most worrisome in the case of Chad, which has hit either a open civil war or a latent civil war for a number of years, is that oil and oil pipelines in particular are a magnet for conflict and war. So there is a likelihood in the context of an undemocratic government, a state without the capacity to distribute oil revenues well, there's a great likelihood that what we'll see if we were doing this program 15 years from now is a very striking rise in the level of conflict.
I'm sure in 15 years we probably will be doing this program, Terry Lynn Carl. But, you know, you pick out Norway and what Norway, the reason Norway stands out is because it's the epitome of good governance, really. But, if you look at the countries of Africa, you mentioned Chad's got a low-level civil war. Of course, you've got Sudan is in desperate straits. Angola always has, and the oil fueled the civil war there. But what about Nigeria now? It's had kleptocracy governments. It's had military governments. Sani Abacha alone, I think, siphoned off about $4.5 billion in oil money, allegedly. I'll throw that in. But now it's got a democratically elected government. Are things working better? Is there a model?
Well, I'm actually glad you brought up Nigeria because for one reason, one thing it does is it puts both Nigeria and Angola put Chad in perspective, if I can put it that way. We're expecting somewhere between $2.5 billion and $6 billion to go to Chad from this pipeline or from this project in the next 25 years, somewhere in those figures. Right now, about $1 billion a year just disappears from Angola. $1 billion a year. In Nigeria, the problem is not whether the country, the government is democratic or authoritarian. That is an important issue. But even under weak democratic governments without strong rule of law, oil money disappears very quickly. Venezuela is a good example of that. So just by virtue of holding elections doesn't mean that somehow the oil revenues will be spent better.
Terry,
that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what we're going
to
see.
Well, you happen to have mentioned Venezuela, and a connection listener wants to bring that up. 1-800-423-8255. Art is in Nashville, Tennessee. And Art, you want to tell us about Venezuela?
Absolutely. I'm originally from Venezuela. I used to work in a major multinational bank. And I did a lot of the international lending to Latin America that today is being refinanced and that's been historically in problems. In particular with the case of Venezuela, none of the previous regimes have ever had a plan to educate the population. As long as you do not educate the population, you are destined to be a poor country. The solution to the permanent solution to bringing all these nations, the third world, out of poverty is education.
Art, thanks very much for that. Terry Lynn Carl, I'm sure you'd agree with that, and what you want
I think he's raised an extremely important question, because if you take all of the oil exporters as a group, again, keep out Norway, and you look at what they do with education, their spending on education is lower than non-oil producing countries that are often far less rich, and it's also far less productive spending. Now, one of the reasons for that is it's why we call oil a part of what economists call a resource curse, is that when you have oil money and you need an economist, you tend to go out and buy one instead of train one. And this is a huge problem in Chad, which is one of the five poorest countries in the world. There are no economists. There are no accountants. There are no people who can monitor the oil companies and make sure that the companies, the banks, the government, et cetera, are in fact doing what they say they do. This is a country that does not have that kind of human capacity. And Art is absolutely right that getting oil doesn't mean you get that kind of human capacity, because what oil revenues allow you to do is they allow you to buy that capacity outside, foreign capacity, and then not educate or train your own people.
Tell me, Terry, who do you think is the most culpable here? Is it up to the oil companies to open the books? Who do you actually blame for things going wrong?
Well, you know, there's an actual group of complicity here, if I can put it that way. What I think is the most important, and it's the thing that is least talked about, is that countries like Chad and Cameroon will never be able to use oil revenues wisely if, first and foremost, they don't get a fair share of those oil revenues. Chad is getting 12.5% of the revenues from its oil. That's all. It used to be, 40 years ago, that there was something called at least a 50-50 agreement between oil companies and countries, and that meant 50% went to the companies, 50% stayed with the governments. That actually got up to even 90% in some cases, and when nationalization occurred, 100%. Now, look what we're looking at now. Now we're looking at a time when these governments are so weak vis-a-vis Exxon or Totofina Elf or any oil company that the best deal they can get is 12.5%, which frankly is nothing. So the first issue, I think, is a fair share.
Yeah.
And that also, in order to guarantee a fair share, it means that we need to know, when I say we, I mean the people in the countries as well as all of us who work on these issues, that we need to know what oil companies are actually paying these countries.
Absolutely. Ambassador Noel and Terry made two points there. One, they haven't got a very good deal, it doesn't seem, at 11%. But also, the countries need to see where the oil money is going outside, like the World Bank needs to see. Why won't the oil companies operating in Chad and Cameroon open their books?
Well, let me answer that very quickly by saying that the oil companies have arrangements with governments concerned, and the governments are often reluctant to disclose exactly how much they are giving to the oil companies, and the oil companies are bound to abide by certain agreements. But Judy, before we go too much farther, let me say there is a great myth that's being created here, and that is that oil creates poverty. All of the countries that we've talked about have received resources other than oil. They've received official development assistance. They've received World Bank loans. They have received significant contributions from non-governmental organizations. Those resources have also been squandered. It is wrong to suggest that oil is in itself, because of its some peculiar nature, is responsible for poverty.
Then if you have a rotten leader who is misappropriating all the funds, shouldn't you wait till you have a decent leader before you
invest in the country? That's why the emphasis in the Chad Cameroon pipeline project has been to assure a different kind of governance. It's to assure that these resources are not disposable simply by the action of a president. That's why the lessons of 50 years, and Terry Carl is a great scholar of those lessons, they show that you cannot operate in accordance with previous arrangements. That's why they have made a condition for the Chad World Bank participation that the resources go to an offshore bank. Terry Carl cannot name another country where resources have gone to an offshore bank before they become available.
Sadly, we're saying farewell to Terry Lynn Carl, and thanks very much. Connection listeners, what do you think? Is oil still Africa's curse? 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the link between oil and poverty in Africa and an experimental project intended to ease poverty while making profits. With me is LA Times staff writer Ken Silverstein and the former ambassador to Chad, Donald Norland. And you, Connection listeners, should America turn to Africa for oil? And can oil help save Africa? If so, how? Call us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Erica's joining us from Somerville, Mass. Hi, Erica. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I had a question about the organization of the World Bank itself, and if I seem to remember correctly, there was quite a bit of controversy about this when it was trying to go through. And I'm curious, given the fact that the World Bank has quite a bit of representation by the U.S. and very, very little representation comparatively by Cameroon and Chad and similar African countries, what are the checks on the World Bank, and how is it that the World Bank is allowed to put that kind of money into a project like this when they know that only 11%, for example, is going to go to a country like Chad?
Ken Silverstein, you've been watching what the World Bank's been up to.
Well, the project was very controversial, and my understanding is that there was a lot of internal dissent at the bank about the project. I mean, I've spoken to people about it. You know, there was concern about the issue of corruption in Chad and Cameroon. There was concern that Chad has been at war for almost all of its four decades of independence, at war, a low-level civil war. There's been a lot of conflict, and that you'd be providing a government that has frequently been at war with a lot of oil revenue, which is not necessarily a good thing. And finally, there was concern that even though this program had been put in place to control the spending, that there would be ways that the Chadian government would find ways to get around spending the money properly. So, for example, the government of Chad might try to co-opt members of the oversight committee, buy them off in some way. Or another possibility would be that, let's say the government of Chad goes to the oversight committee and says, we want $1 million to build a school. And the oversight committee says, that's wonderful, here's your $1 million. Well, it's possible that the government will build the school. The school might have a lot of cost inflation. The contract might go to somebody who's close to the president, and in the end, the school might not have proper staffing. I mean, these were the sorts of concerns that were raised by people who felt that, you know, the government of Chad would find ways of getting around the restrictions.
Absolutely.
In any case, it was hotly debated. The bank did go forward with it. The U.S. does have a very large role in determining the way the World Bank votes. It's the number one shareholder, and it has a lot of influence at the World Bank. And so the U.S. vote for the project was very significant. It wasn't decisive, but it was very significant.
Ambassador Nolan, what's your response to this? Because you said that the great thing about this deal was that the World Bank was deeply involved and it had great oversight, but the World Bank doesn't have an unsullied track record of projects like this.
Indeed not. And that's one of the things that I wanted to highlight. The fact is that every source of funding, every source of capital, every source of revenue throughout the particularly the Third World has been squandered in to some degree, and the World Bank is not without its responsibility. Let me just correct a couple of things. First of all, the figure that I have for the Chad percentage of Chad's gain from the project is 36%. I don't know where the figure 12% comes from. I'd be very interested to know. The second point I do want to stress, Judy, thank you for giving me the opportunity, is you have talked about poverty in Africa. Do you realize that only a few countries in Africa have oil? But poverty is widespread. Virtually every country in Africa, with three or four exceptions, has a lower rate of economic growth and a higher poverty rate today than they did, as one of your participants pointed out, than they did upon independence 40-some years ago.
But the key question, Ambassador, is this oil actually going to improve the lot of the average Chadian? I mean, there are a handful of people in Nigeria who've done very well, thank you, out of its billions and billions of oil, but not Nigerians.
If there's one thing the Chad project is trying to do, it is to avoid the example of Nigeria, of Angola, and of a half a dozen other countries in Africa that have really squandered their resources.
Quite a legacy
that
to overcome. 800-423-8255 to join the conversation. Erica, thanks for your call. Let's hear now from Manasseh, who's in Somerville, Mass. Hi, Manasseh.
Hi, Judy. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the program. I beg already to disagree with the ambassador on this show, because I come from Cameroon, and this particular project has been a subject of my study for the last 12, 13 years. And one thing I'd like to know is, why was there this differentiation between the escrow account for Chad and for Cameroon, as if to say Chad is more corrupt or less capable of managing its money than Cameroon? I would like to know what went to it, because Cameroon, before now, Cameroon had oil, and that oil was off the budget of the country. And nobody ever questioned it, neither from the West. There are people suffering in Cameroon. We hear it. You heard from Mr. Samuel, who spoke from Yaoundé, about AIDS. It seemed to be the new trend now. And I was reading something on the Boston Globe 2 days ago that AIDS in Africa seemed to be following a migratory process. So if people keep moving up and down, following projects like this pipeline that goes 600 and something miles across the country, you can see what the impact will be. I don't want to go into details.
Let's put the question to the ambassador. Ambassador, the charge there, Cameroon got a rotten deal.
Well, indeed. And the reason is that the Cameroon National Assembly never passed legislation such as the law of the Chad National Assembly passed in late 98, which reads, let me just read Article 3. Which directly affects the questioner. The direct income referred to shall be deposited in an offshore escrow account opened specifically for this purpose by the government of Chad and an international financial institution.
But what the call is
that
asking
is
why
the case of,
exactly why wasn't the same deal struck for Cameroon? Why weren't the same rules enforced for Cameroon?
Because the Cameroon government did not request it, because no pressure was put on the Cameroon government, as was the case in Chad, where the World Bank said, we will not associate ourselves with this project unless there is this kind of a guarantee.
Well, shouldn't they have said the same for Cameroon? I don't quite understand it. You're saying, on the one hand, in Chad, the onus is on the external groups, the World Bank, to monitor what's
right.
going on and to cut a deal so that the government is cut out of the deal and can't dip its fingers into the oil money. In Cameroon, you're saying, oh, no, they didn't request for any safeguards, so they didn't get them.
It's not just in Cameroon that didn't request it or no pressure was put on. Neither was pressure put on Angola, Nigeria, Congo-Brazzaville, Gabon, Indonesia. None of these countries had a provision comparable to the one I just read. It is unprecedented, and that's what, as I say, gives hope that the resources by this means are placed beyond the control of the president or of any particular group of his followers. This is what's unique about the Chad Cameroon, about the Chad
Cameroon got a rotten deal.
They did. And it was something which the Cameroon people and government could have done something about.
But where should the pressure have come from? If there was pressure on Chad, why was there not pressure on Cameroon?
Because there was no mobilization of either Cameroonian or other opinion. And as I say, this has been a cumulative effect over some 30 or 40 years. The realization, something the bank only came to in late 1990s, and that is that it was impossible to avoid the problems of diversion of resources as long as these resources go directly to the treasury of a country which is under the control of its president.
There you go, Manasseh. So, it's your government's fault, I'm afraid. 800-423-8255. Eduardo is joining us from Yorktown in Virginia. Eduardo, hi.
Hello. Thanks, Judy, for the program. I'm glad that the conversations turn out on corruption, because I think the main problem with developing countries is corruption. And the IMF and the sister entity, the World Bank, has a history of lending money to military dictatorships and other corrupt governments. So it's interesting that the point has switched now. Perhaps there should be some kind of action on the part of these institutions not to lend to corrupt governments, because that doesn't benefit anybody except the corrupt.
Absolutely. Ken, you know, how do you get around this? They're basically saying the poacher is the gamekeeper, or the gamekeeper is the poacher. Who do you trust?
Well, let me address that and also go back to your previous caller. I think one of the reasons that there are no restrictions on Cameroon is that the bank didn't have any leverage on Cameroon. Cameroon was receiving, I think it's like less than 1% of its budget is going to come from the oil revenues. It's not getting that much money. So they didn't have leverage in Cameroon. And the government of Cameroon, of course, has no interest in restrictions, because the government of Cameroon has a terrible track record. I mean, the president, Paul Biya, is perhaps best known in his own country for building this magnificent 9-hole professional golf course near his home village. He spends an immense amount of time away from the capital. He loves to be out on the golf course. Cameroon has had oil revenue for a long time. At one point, it had, I believe, I'm told, this could be apocryphal, but I'm told this by a number of people, including people from the oil industry, it had the second highest per capita consumption of champagne in the world. So it squandered all of its oil wealth. The bank did have leverage in Chad. It could force Chad, which is going to get at least half of its budget from the oil revenues, to agree to these terms. The question remains, though, will the bank have leverage after the government of Chad gets the starts getting these oil revenues?
Absolutely. Eduardo, thanks for your point. Let's put that point to Ambassador Norland. Ambassador, the proof will be when the oil starts flowing. What guarantees are there then that the money will go where it's supposed to?
Well, of course, that is the key. And I believe the agreements now take us through 2006. They can be renewed. As a matter of fact, in talk of further oil development in Chad, I understand that the ExxonMobil and the World Bank have insisted that the Chadian government give assurance that any new fines will also come under the same provisions of the current agreement, which is to say that the resources will be used for the purposes outlined in the legislation. Let me just add, you know, because of the lessons of some 50 years, the World Bank and they convinced ExxonMobil and the government of Chad that something different would have to be done before they would participate in this project. Even ExxonMobil said, we make our participation conditional upon some kind of a new arrangement whereby we're not going to be saddled with the accusation that we have contributed to the corruption and to the squandering of resources. So this is, I have to repeat, the Chad aspect of this project is unique. It is unprecedented, and it serves as a potential model for other countries.
The thing is, Ken Silverstein, isn't the problem from what you've seen there on the ground, is that they can say, okay, yeah, sure, we're going to put this number of billions of dollars to help alleviate poor. The poverty alleviation programs have no infrastructure. They don't know where to put the money.
Well, the question of how to manage the money is going to be a big problem. I mean, the government of Chad, there is very little capacity there to manage the money. You know, they were supposed to be putting in place all sorts of programs as the pipeline was being built, so that they would be prepared to manage the money. And the World Bank itself has issued a number of internal reports that are critical of what's been going on with the pipeline. And one of the criticisms from the bank itself is that while pipeline construction has proceeded very quickly, and in fact, I think they completed it a year ahead of schedule, the construction of the projects to manage the money and to ensure that it is spent properly are behind schedule. And so the oil's coming online and all the programs that were supposed to be in place by now are not in place. Even the Oversight Committee, its own internal rules were finally just approved, I think, within the last month. They were going over, they had some handbook of internal rules and regulations. But that's, you know, there are a number of cases where you find that the government and the World Bank is behind schedule in putting in place the programs that were supposed to be there now manage this money.
Ambassador Norland, one quick word. If we are back together talking about this in 10 years' time, do you think we'll be talking about a much wealthier Chadian individual?
I believe honestly that the spin-off effect, the total impact of this project on the entire entire economy of Chad, and I could give you examples of how that's already starting to affect the life, the daily life of Chadians.
Not in 20 seconds.
It is going to make this a better country. It's going to have less poverty. They have entered the mainstream of the world economy. They will have been forced.
Ambassador Norland, former Ambassador Chad, my thanks too to Ken Silverstein of the LA Times, to Terry Lynn Carl, political science professor and author, and Samuel Nguifo in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Our senior producer on The Connection is Tara Murphy. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon.